This is Henry Wyatt, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of July, 2013. Henry Wyatt, Part 2. John Smith sent his best wishes.
Oh, good, John. What a great man he is.
Whilst John was on cooking duty during a blizzard, Henry went out to collect the dog feces from a programme he's running, some on seal, other on nutty. And he later appeared in the kitchen covered in ice. So John asked Henry what had happened.
Was that when he locked, John locked me out, I think it was? Was that the episode? What was said, sorry?
It's to do with the penguin being encroaching into the dog's space.
Oh, the penguin pusher thing, yes, yes. There was a sort of gully, lots of penguins in it, and I made a long board on a handle and managed to push the whole lot of the penguins down the gully. Is this the story?
Why would you want to do that?
Well, to get them away from the dog's van, because they'd kill a dog and that would ruin their part in the experiment, you see. This wasn't at Stonington, this was at Base W.
Right.
But anyway, the penguins went over, but I lost my footing and went over too. So I had a bit of a problem getting round the corner and out of the water because nobody knew where I was, you see. But sorry, that's
the one, yes.
It is the one, that's Base W, yes. And got kind of wet. The windproof garments, when they're wet, are impervious to air, of course, so I had a built-in life jacket at least for a few minutes and managed to get out. But yes, that was... I thought you were referring to some sort of good-natured or even bad-natured quarrel with John Smith when he locked me out.
Tell me about that.
Inadequately. I don't remember too much about it except, I don't know, I was probably doing a snow bath or some of the silly things one does, you know. And he locked the door, so there you are running round the hut, longing to get inside. And
were you fully clothed?
No, naked.
Why were you running round the hut naked?
Well, I must have had my conscious on or something. I don't know, but then, you know, sort of invigorate the soul or something idiotic like that, you know.
Was this a dare?
No. I don't remember the details, okay. You know. They're small points, but there's always these idiot games going on.
So this is on detail, aren't you?
That's on detail, John Smith. Yes.
So this would be also where the kayak...
Yes.
Tell me about your kayak that you built.
Yes. I'd been one of the interests during student years, it was frustrated, of course, was kayaking, and I'd joined a kayak rolling circus demonstrating Eskimo rolls around the country, well, some of the country anyway. So I decided to build a kayak, and I did that with all lashing, no metal screws, nails and so on, and sewed on a cover from an old canvas tarpaulin. And yes, I've got some really nice photographs of that. And I did roll it a little bit. And again, it was a lovely boat. But again, you know, when you should have been dead, you know, these things, out to a berg, I don't know, a quarter mile, half a mile off the island, and then the wind strengthening and the seas abeam to get back. But it was, of course, the Eskimo kayaks are pretty. So you were quartering or eighth, just trying to drift across in the wind. And get back, of course, you get back. I'm here now. But these sort of things are when you get pretty close to the edge. But it was a lovely kayak. I liked it very much. The Bisco was once stuck in a lead, I remember, because I took it back down to Stonington and I got in it and had a lovely time running up and down the lead when two whales appeared in the same lead, not 50 yards wide. So yeah, I got out of it pretty quickly. They wouldn't have harmed me, I'm sure, but it was nerve-wracking.
Did you ever genuinely fear for your life?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm sure all of us did, you know. But, let's see, if I may just digress for a second, there is one record in the diaries that I'd completely forgotten. On Detail Islet, we lost a dog, and we found her 3 days later, 18 feet down, a crevasse crack up on the island. We tried to get her descending head up and couldn't reach her. And eventually, I think it's a major accomplishment, Martin Scarfe allowed us to tie it. Have you talked to Martin at all?
Recently, yes. Yeah.
Recently. I don't know what he's doing now. He was a great... Anyway, he was lowered head first down the crevasse, and in that way was able to stretch down and get the dog out. So, I think that was quite something. Did he tell you about the dog? Yes.
Yes.
What did he think about it?
I can't even remember exactly, but he was certainly... It's one of those ones where you think afterwards, well, what if?
Yes, of course. Of course. I thought he was pretty good to get that thing out, yes. Yes.
So that suggests that there were no real health and safety regulations to be obeyed.
Oh, no.
In your time down there?
No, yeah. No. Are there now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, there would be, of course. It's a new world, isn't it? Different travel and so
just,
on. Yes.
Just going back to this kayak, then. Did you ever have occasion to demonstrate...
The kayak,
demonstrate rolling over in it?
Do you mean, did I ever get tumbled and had to roll upright? No, not that I remember. No, I don't remember that happening.
You don't remember demonstrating the rolls?
Well, I might have shown the boys just in the back bay. I can't remember. I might have done that in the back bay.
John Edwards thinks you gave prizes to the men on your medical programmes.
No.
Whole box of dairy milk for having the most fat.
I don't remember anything about that.
Okay. And do you remember a chap called Colonel Jim Adam?
Yes.
What were you doing with him?
He was a major in the medical corps. He'd been in the Korean War. After I came back, I worked for a year or two with the MRC, because at that time the Empire was contracting, and the MRC had this concept of a mobile force that could, in 24 hours, move to Arctic or tropical climates. Would that affect them? So the question was whether cold adaptation and heat acclimatization were mutually exclusive. So Jim was leading all that, and I went with the MRC team to Aden and to Singapore with Jim as the leader. But being a civilian, I was given an equivalent rank. And for example, I remember on the plane to Singapore, I outranked my boss. So how did you come across Jimmy Adam, by the way?
It was a note from Alan Weirden. I think it was a hint from John Edwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Jimmy, so that was all after the time in heat acclimatization studies for the MRC. But I was a very junior scientist.
Did the research come to any conclusions?
The part that I know came to conclusions was whether heat acclimatization could be mimicked in a hot room in London, exercise in a hot room in London, or by overdressing and heavy exercise in Scotland, or by work in Aden. And I know that the result of that was that the work in Aden was the best acclimatization, not because it had anything to do with heat, but the guys in Aden had got through the diarrhoea and all these other things and blisters, which the other guys hadn't. Yeah, that's the only bit that I remember of that.
Let's talk about some of the journeys you made. Peter Gibbs says that you seem to spend more time in the field than anybody else at Stonington that summer. So you must be on two or three quite substantial
I think
trips.
That's probably true. The ones were the fall journey for the depots, I've got huge gratitude to Peter because he made the whole thing 2 years worthwhile through this. Anyway, the fall journey to try to find the other route south, other route west, east. The journey searching for the three men, the geological journey with Nigel, and the summer journey with Pete Foster and Pete Gibbs, three men, three teams. That was a wonderful experience. Oh, wonderful. But it had its very hairy moments.
Such as?
Well, you've probably got the record. It was particularly when we were down at the bottom of what's now the Gibbs Glacier, where it opens out onto the Finsner Shelf. So many of these episodes, but this particular one, I was the back of the three sledges. It was time to camp. Well, I think you might have seen it in the journey account. Pete called a halt, so we were to picket the dogs. I took my picket to the back of the sledge and gave it one blow, and a 3 foot hole opened up just into a black nothing, which I'm standing on, you know. I mean, terrifying, really. Gingerly stepped back from that and moved on. We all moved on a couple of hundred yards more, and believe it, it happened a second time, you know. You were standing on these chasms that were hidden by covering snow. I think it happened a third time, I'm not sure, but at any rate, eventually we said, well, we must be in a field of these things, so let's just probe around and get one secure place and anchor there and camp. But you can't possibly get closer to that than the edge, can you, really? So that was a pretty close one, yeah. But anyway, that was a wonderful journey with Pete, with the two Peters. They were just great. I have a photograph that I treasure of the three of us on Christmas Day 1958, sitting on a sledge. The day before, oh, two things, if I may, there. Pete Foster, what a guy. He would say, I'm not going to eat anything for 24 hours. And on a sledge journey where we were losing weight and working like crazy, he would do that. No food for 24 hours. But the day after Christmas Day, he took his jersey off running up the glacier on a high Sunday and got the worst sunburn I could ever imagine. I mean, torso blistered fore and aft. I'm sure nowadays they would call it very, very dangerous because of fluid loss. Anyway, those were the journeys, and those are the good times that make all the bad times disappear. Yeah.
How do you mean? What is it about being out in the field on a good day that raises a soul?
I don't know. I like lonely places. I like the back of beyond. The comradeship, travelling into the unknown. It's so hard to describe, isn't it? But it is an enormous. I was going to say hi. I've been very interested in submarines, and one of the history of submarines has an account of a reunion of Pacific submariners, where the writer says that what meant the most to all these remnants in their lives was the time in the submarines in the Pacific War. And I thought you couldn't describe better what the good times in the Antarctic mean. It's of course you marry and you have a family and you have a career, but still this is such a high point, probably never to be equaled, really, for the good times. The bad times, as I say, there, but they're best forgotten. There are a lot of them.
They come out quite a lot. Your diary here, I've got of the autumn journey from the 8th of April to the 18th of April, I think it might be, yes, until the 6th of June, 58. And of those 50 days in the field, a third of them were spent lying up, weren't they?
That's right. But and that is, it, of course, it's a miserable experience, but it still has that quality of, I don't know, is it schoolboyish to call it adventure? It's at the front. It's special. It's special, but those hours are miserable day after day. Half rations, half fuel, and so on. They weren't happy times, but the whole experience was good.
There were times when you were fearful your tent might get blown away.
Well, that's true for me, but I don't know if Peter has told you of their camp in the Nini Fjord. Has he told you of that?
Go on.
Oh, he and Pete Foster wanted to go round it to look at the western part of the Nini Trough. Actually, I think Vivian Fuchs used his photograph because they camped on a little islet and a huge blizzard eroded everything around them. And there was you've perhaps seen the photograph, the tent just stuck on a sculpted ice drift. Anyway, the one for us was the one down the Northwest Glacier, what I now know are katabatic winds. Obviously learned a lot more.
What was it like in the tent that day?
Well, just as I describe in the diary, it'd be dead quiet, and then one of these huge bolus, big, of cold, cold air would come battering down the glacier. You could hear it just like a train coming at you. And everything would shake like crazy, and then it would be gone and you'd be calm again. But as I wrote in the diary, you were worried enough to put on all your clothes and tie yourself to the apex rope in the tent and stake down the tent with ice axes and so on. Those katabatic winds are fierce.
You did quite a lot of man-hauling, as all man-shifting on that particular trip. You were trying to get depots up onto the plateau.
Yes.
And the loads are too heavy for the sledges, dogs.
Yes, they were big slopes, one in two and a half, something like that. The dogs couldn't possibly pull that up. So, yes, that was those were heavy carries. Big burden days, yes. To the, there's the, in polite language, the soda bread slope. You've come across that, I'm sure, in other contexts, and in our language, sodomy slope, to the amphitheatre, and then the lift from the amphitheatre to the plateau were lots of work. I don't know how much we got up there, £800, £1,000, I don't know, but it was a slog. Getting up there, yeah.
Both men and dogs were quarrelsome today. How moods change with circumstance. Is that a classic entry?
Well, it's so true, isn't it? Yeah, one always has those experiences any time in life. But yes, from hard times and you grit your teeth and feel down about it all, and then the next day's good. And well, at least my moods change with circumstances, and I'm not altogether atypical of a human specimen, am I?
Well, yes, you have got a lot of trouble with icing up, didn't you? Sleeping bags, anoraks, a lot. And there's quite a good description of what would happen if you banged your head against a tent on the inside and be a shower of icicles.
Frost, yes. Frost crystals, that's true. I mean, it's worth just recording again that business going down what now is called my glacier when we lost my jersey and Peter's anorak.
Well, tell me about that, because it must have put the fear inside you.
Well, it did. We'd gone up the hill on the southeast side of it and saw it could run, and down we went, skedaddle, big speed, and my jersey and his anorak had disappeared. Well, I mean, hot, so you take them off. We backtracked when we'd pitched camp and found my jersey, but we never found his anorak. And obviously no windproof in those conditions is really death, or likely death. So we spent a day or two I think we made it out of the, you know, the cover bag that the tent slipped into, hatched up something for him there, enough that he was able to protect himself from wind. But that could have been a very, very serious event, obviously. Yeah.
And did the replacement makeshift anorak do the job?
Oh, yes, yes. Mind you, Peter is very tough, you know. You're right, you see, the sweating reaches a frost line within the insulation of a sleeping bag, or an underbag for that matter, so you get accumulating water in your sleeping gear. If you remember the people from Scott's time, they used reindeer bags and shook the frost out, but we couldn't exactly do that, and as Pete was much worse off than I was. I mean, you're sleeping on a sodden sheepskin mat and sometimes had the plane table for survey underneath him to keep him off. No, it would get pretty uncomfortable, yeah. Yeah.
You complain about cold feet and being damp all the time. When you were running out of primer stove fuel.
Yes, I can't remember that other than the notes in the diary. But yes, this business of condensation in clothing is certainly an issue. Yeah.
So where was it when you were? Where had you been when you were coming home, over heaving sea ice and reached the base after dark?
Oh, that was at Detail Isle at Frank Oliver, and I had gone to Andreasen Island. Remember. And that was at from Andreasen to Base W. The others were pretty angry at us for going at all, you know, and of course we were defensive, it was all safe and so on. But as I say, next morning, not one speck of ice to be seen, just a few bergs. That was pretty close, wasn't it?
So yeah. How did you get back?
Well, we manhauled back over the slightly moving ice.
In the dark?
Well, got back in the dark, yes. It's foolishness, isn't it? But people... foolishness often kills.
Then
yeah. There you go.
Fortune favours the brave.
Yeah, perhaps it does.
In your case, it seems to have done.
Well, it did in that case, yeah.
You mentioned the glacier. Mm-hmm. This is the big trick with Peter was to try and find another route across the top of the peninsula.
The purpose of the journey, as I understood it, was to lay depots for a long summer journey and to look for another route down to the Filchner, because the previous route, Bill's Gulch, was heavily crevassed and wasn't popular. So that's how we came across the glacier. It was a wonderful experience, because as we went down it, or was it the next day, the wind was from the northwest, blowing drift off the west side, the sharp edge of the west side of the glacier, and the very, very low sun behind it coloured it crimson or red, so that we went down this and it was exactly like flames along the whole ridge carrying on this drift. And we called it at that time the Flaming Peaks Glacier. But yes, that was a very special time, yes. Yeah.
So tell me about the sense of achievement when you actually found you could get into this passage through the
mountains. Well, there wasn't any, because we were stuck there for 5 days, you know. And the diary shows that the first day we felt we could get away, we only got half a mile in thigh-deep snow and felt even more desperate. It was getting a bit tight. Because obviously in those days there was no rescue, no possibility of rescue. The days rolled by and you endure. You kind of... Over to you.
So at some point you would have reported back to Bass HQ that you had in fact found, FIDS HQ you had found The Northwest Passage, the equivalent of the Northwest Passage.
I don't know about that. Peter may have done that, but it never occurred to me at the time that this was a... the diary shows this feeling of looking on at something where nobody had ever trodden, and because it had been photographed from the air, remember. Yeah. No one had trodden, no one ever been down it, and being the first human down there, it was quite a kick, that one. Yeah, yeah.
Just knowing you were the first man to do this.
Yeah, yeah. But the reporting to the to Port Stanley was clearly the base leader's job and so on, and not mine, yes.
When did you, or how did you find out they named this glacier after you?
Many, many years later. I think I must have been in Canada by then. Yeah. That was...
Did they tell you?
Sorry?
Did they write and tell you? Or?
I can't remember. Maybe Peter told me.
Mm.
I don't know.
Most of it's found out circuitously.
Yeah, I think...
There was no letter system, to say, by the way, we named it.
No, that's... But it was a major high, I don't know. In fact, I've done a lot of things in life, but that is the one of which I'm... Sorry, my marriage is the one I'm most proud of, but that would be next. Yeah.
Well rescued, sir.
Yeah, good, good.
Was that where you got the Polar Medal?
Oh, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I was delighted with both. Delighted with both. Remember Alastair Cook?
Yes. Letter from America.
Yes. I mean, it's incidental to all this, but the day we went to the palace for the bone, you know, his bones were... There was an awful scandal about his bones being sold in the undermarket for bone grafting and Lord knows what. Do you know about that? Well, look it up. It was a scandal in North America. But at any rate, we were walking out of the palace. What a wonderful experience. And there was Alastair Cook being photographed, this famous fellow. And we said to the photographers, do you mind just getting us on a photograph? And they said, no.
He refused.
Of course he did. Anyway. No, I don't know how I learned about the Polar Medal, but I was so proud of both, yes. Yes.
What brought you to South Georgia?
Well, I was that... I really was in a... I think I must have spent my life in a bad mental condition, but at any rate, I was in a bad condition when I got back, so I worked with the MRC, and then...
Sorry, let me just stop you there.
Yes.
You were in a bad way when you got back to Britain.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Why?
Well, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd been a bit wild places and had to settle down, and I'd been out of medicine for 2 years, and so anyway,
was it a bit of a come down to come back?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. It was a shock, for example, since one's parents were with teeth when you left and without teeth when you... You know, all these little things that you notice. Mm. But, yes, it was a shock. And I didn't know what I... But the point of the story is that MRC and then, I think, the film, we might talk about that, but then my father couldn't bear the fact that I was lounging around home not knowing what I wanted to do. So I eventually slipped an application into the letterbox for an advertised position at the Oxford Eye Hospital, a position that had closed 2 weeks earlier. The application landed on the desk, as a trainee that would be, of course, the application landed on the desk on the day that the man who had been offered the job declined it, and on the day that his follow-up had already found a job, and one of the surgeons there, which I don't think I knew at the time, was Peter Gibbs's uncle. I mean, how lucky do you get? Anyway, that was the start of the ophthalmology, And I wanted then to get my surgical qualification, and I got a job in anatomy. And at that, but that was 6 months ahead, and at that point, Dr. Slessor said, would you come to a locum?
Why was that? Why did you get the invitation?
Well, I guess Dr. Slessor remembered me, and I liked him very much and admired him, and I suppose he thought of me. I don't know why he would ask me.
This would be how many months in Port Stanley?
3 months Stanley, 3 months South Georgia.
Oh, right. Yes. And you'd met Barbara, your wife, by that time?
Oh, yes, we had a little boy by then.
So the whole family moved south?
Yes, yes, it was lovely. It was just lovely. it was great.
What were you doing on Stanley?
Well, you know, it's a sort of general practice, but I don't think I was very good at it. But anyway, there I was, the general practitioner, and we lived in the big house just by the docks on the other side from all the other houses. And we were told that the hangman's gallows had been at the place where our gate was, the front gate. Of course, the wind there is always, so the gate used to creak and we used to get quite nervous. But no, it was a very, very interesting interlude. And then, of course, on to South Georgia, which was just as interesting. Just as interesting.
Well, you were in Shackleton territory on South Georgia.
Sorry, what?
Shackleton territory in South Georgia.
Yes, yes, indeed, yes. Photographs of Barbara holding the little fella in front of Shackleton's memorial cross and so on. Yes, it was a good break. The story that to me has the most significance about South Georgia was that every second day, the meteorologist, David, whose second name I can't remember, and I would put on cross-country skis and go wandering off over the pass and over the pass and over the pass. One day we were coming back, and at the first call, we looked in the snow, and there were rat tracks, just a few. So down into the valley and up to the next call, more and more rat tracks. So over that call, and then the last call, an army of rat tracks, enormous. So we followed these all the way down to the whaling station, and they didn't go into the station or onto the platform or anything. They all went to the graveyard and disappeared under the tombs. So, strange experience. Anyway, that South Georgia was good. Very good.
You were living in the Bass HQ there, were you?
No, not Bass HQ, in King Edward Point.
Oh, right, OK.
Yeah. It was good.
I mean, there's very little medical work to do with young fit FIDs on base, but did you find yourself doing more medical work in Falklands and South Georgia?
Well, Falklands, perhaps, general practice kinds of work. Though some, what I know now, I would have done differently. But general practice, and in South Georgia, healthy people, nothing to do, just enjoy yourself, you know. Oh, go do an inventory of the medical equipment every few days and so on. It was time out for sure. But an excellent experience, and Barbara enjoyed it, and our little boy doesn't remember it, of course. No. He's grown now. But yes, that was a great time.
When it came to leave, the time to leave Marguerite Bay, of course you couldn't get out, could you?
No, I was unclear about that, and until I started to read the diaries, we couldn't get out. I thought we went out to the ice edge, and were picked up there and changed with the crew. But the diaries show that we went up to Base Y, and we were evacuated from Base Y by North Wind helicopters.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so you sledged to Base Y?
Yes, yes, yes.
And the North Wind, of course, is the American icebreaker?
The American icebreaker, that's right.
Is that an easy job to get you out, or is it still fraught?
Well, helicopters, it seemed kind of easy to me. And it was a good last journey. By that time, the thaw was on and the ice was wet and so on and so on. But yes, it was a... We were... of course, there was the consideration that you might not be able to get out. And so you can see in the diaries the anxiety about maybe having to stay another year.
Yes.
But
Peter Gibbs, I think, also was concerned.
Oh, I'm sure he was. But anyway, it worked out well in the end. There's a story, I think we went round to Base W after that, because I think they evacuated Base W. Have you got that on record? That, yeah, I think they evacuated Base W, but I have a note of one dog that escaped and simply would not be taken, and he was left, unfortunately, to his fate. I don't remember that part other than what I'd written in the diary.
Base W is detail.
Hmm?
Base W is
detail. Yes, detail, that's right, yes.
But it was abandoned, and then it became a refuge hut for one winter.
Okay.
There was an inventory party sent to take an inventory of what was in the hut. Right. And they themselves got trapped there.
Oh, did they? Not for a winter, surely?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I think my memory's correct on that. And eventually when they came out, again, they were had to be airlifted out.
Okay.
And that's why Base W was then abandoned.
It's strange that the ice blocked the evacuation, and yet part of its difficulty as a survey base was its... unstable ice. It's odd, isn't it? But I think I am right in that, aren't I?
Yeah, I'm sure you are.
Yeah, yeah.
What's an MRC box?
It was a box of... well, now maybe I've got it wrong. It was a new box of rations. Pemmican was changed for... was the Nutrican the dog food or the man food? I can't remember.
Nutrican was dog food.
What I do remember, as we went back to Dennis Goldring and the Knights in the Snow Hole, I think they were eating dog pemmican. Did he say that?
I didn't know.
Yes, it says in the diary here that they told me they'd had to eat dog pemmican. I think so. I can find it later and confirm.
Well, how successful was the MRC box?
I don't remember. I can't. Okay. I don't remember making any reports on it. There must have been a lot of these little research projects which were sort of fill-ins and justifications and whatnot. What more need I say?
Do, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you think... You're still in touch with the Antarctic lifestyle today, if only through the media.
Hmm.
What do you regard as the biggest advances or changes since, you know, 50 years since you were there? 55 years?
I'll preface to reply another connection between Alberta and the South. It's that one of the principal pilots for Bass is the son of a colleague doctor, or was so. Pearson, Doug Pearson.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Have you talked to him at all?
I think I have.
Yes, you have. I'm interested in that question because the time between our leaving Antarctica and now is greater than the time between our leaving Antarctica and Scott Amundsen. So we were, I think, at the tail end of the... Well, obviously, we were at the tail end of the classic methods of winter party, depots, dogs, and no rescue possibility.
Mm.
Shortly after that, I remember the dogs were banned from Antarctica, weren't they? And flying in became possible. And I'm sure that's transformed the whole thing. Wintering parties can be relieved. Summer parties can do the work and get home. No dogs to look after. Tractors are reliable and so on. So I think of our time as the end of a classic era and the beginning of massive change.
Should that be mourned, or should that be praised? those changes?
Oh, one should never mourn progress as long as it's... the facility with which work is done now is so much greater. Oh, no, it's massive progress. But I'm very glad that I belonged to that time. My boy now is a director of Hostelling International in Western Canada, and recently, in fact, in September, I'm going to give a talk to them about the time in the Antarctic in relation to cruise ships. I'm saying that because the talk is entitled Antarctica Before the Sledge Dogs Left. But that really was the big transition in my mind, yes. Yes.
Did you form the Moomins, who were put together from the survivors or the escapees from Base Y tragedy?
Yeah.
How was it? How did you go about forming a dog team under your leadership from those dogs?
I don't think I can answer that question. By the way, I understand that they all died later in that subsequent tragedy at the amphitheatre. Was it at the amphitheatre?
I don't
the
know
two that. Men who died with all the dogs. I think they got to the amphitheatre, either under Walton's Peak or at the amphitheatre. But that was the team that I'd had. No, I don't know how to answer your question. You know, I think the thing that characterises our time is that we were sort of novices stumbling around, learning how to live in a hostile environment. And so training dogs, okay, well, you do it, and if the dogs won't go, tie someone on a rope and send him ahead. And you know, in that sense, it was classic British amateurism, wasn't it?
But were you aware of having to build a team?
No. Who was boss? They'll work together, they will. The lead dog, I think, was Susie. Such a lovely dog she was. And as if you have a lead dog, a bitch, and she comes on heat, you never have any difficulty moving, because all the fellas behind her, all they can see is what they want. So, no, I don't remember any particular difficulty, particularly if you were the second in line. If you're trying to run a single team, it's a bit different. But we learned on the job and did it badly or well, I don't know, but it worked.
What was this filming work you got involved in later on?
Let me see now. The film was The Savage Innocents, and it starred Anthony Quinn and Peter O'Toole, and they had a bunch of dogs from around the Hudson's Bay, which were quarantined in Pinewood Film Studio. So they asked if I would look after the dogs and train them whatever way was necessary.
How did they know about you?
Well, I suppose through FIDS. I never...
Oh, I see. Okay.
I've no idea.
Yeah.
Again, it was fiddling around when I should have been getting on with career. But anyway, that was a very, very interesting time indeed. I understand it's later become a cult film because Nicholas Ray, James Dean's director, was in charge of it. It seems to me much later he grew more and more eccentric, but at any rate, so it's now become a cult film, but I don't think Peter O'Toole ever acknowledged it. I think they dubbed his voice or something, didn't they? It's worth researching.
Have you seen it?
Oh, I went to the first running of it. Yes, I was invited. Nowadays, I would certainly have been on the title pages because of the way films are, and no doubt the unions. Perhaps you'd know more about that. But in those days, I wasn't anywhere on the title pages.
Was it as bad as they say it was?
No.
It was a flop, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a flop, all right. But as I say, it's become a cult. I mean, it was an amazing time, really. There are For example, they had polar bears, so it was a huge set, and they put the camera crew in a cage in the middle of the set and then released the polar bears into the set. And there was no way the camera crew was going to get out until the polar bears came back to the polar bear train. All these strange things, you know. It was an interesting time.
So this was an Arctic film, then, or had they got that wrong?
No, it was Arctic. It was about supposed to be about an Eskimo who'd, Anthony Quinn, and I think he'd killed somebody, and then Peter O'Toole, the Mountie, had to go and arrest him and so on. I talk about it's a good time, because obviously it's had ups and downs, but I got bitten by one of the dogs.
Oh.
And had to...
Was that your fault or his fault?
Well, he was hungry. I had to go through the whole
tetanus.
No, rabies thing. And that wasn't pleasant at all. A day or two later, Peter O'Toole was bitten by the same dog and absolutely refused any sort of treatment and came to no harm. I mean, all these things were going on each day. It was good. Good time. But nothing to do with medicine.
No, or the Antarctic.
Well, no.
Tell me a bit more about your locum on Falkland Islands. Did Barbara settle well to the islands?
Oh, yes. She's a very adventuresome person, you know, and she had a good time too.
Were you working in the hospital?
Well, no. There's the hospital and then out to the settlements in, you know, the Beaver on floats.
You were a flying doctor then?
Well, a little bit. All the Falkland Island doctors are flying doctors. It is a beaver place. I mean, there are such strange things happen. And obviously, legion stories, but one, as an example of the kind of thing, was that a shepherd was having had a good evening in his cups, was on his way back on his horse and saw a rabbit. So there's the horse's head and its ears. So he rested the rifle on its horse's head like
Between
that.
The ears.
Oh, and pulled the trigger. Of course, the horse threw him off. But it turned out that the poor man had fallen off not because the horse threw him, but because he'd had a stroke. So he lay there all night on the Falklands Moor, and the paralysed leg from the stroke kept the blood flow fine because all the sympathetic constrictors were not working. The poor man... The other sound leg got vasoconstrictor, and he lost his leg because of the gangrene. You know, strange stories, but anyway, there they are. There's lots of that sort. Not as bad as that, but it was an interesting practice.
So, was it possible to do the amputation job at Stanley Hospital?
I can't. No. I can't remember how we dealt with that. I can't remember. But I do have a photograph of the leg. But the leg is still attached to the man, the photograph. I don't know what we did. I can't remember. You go on.
What other cases did you come across?
It wasn't so much the cases, but it was, you know, the landlines for the phone, and someone would phone from 100 miles away for some advice, and then you'd hear click, click, as each of the phones along the line had a listen. You know? it was okay. I'm sure I... I don't think I was a very good doctor, but I was a happy one.
Were you ever called upon to use your medical skills actually in the Antarctic?
For the dogs, often. For the men, rarely.
The stitching of dogs, was this?
Well, abscesses, bites... canine obstetrics and so on, and occasionally for the men, mostly things like teeth, and cuts and bruises and so on, infected cuts and whatnot, antibiotic. But no, I didn't have to use whatever medical skills I had very much there at all. It's,
and as, again, the doctor being slightly apart from the base, I'm thinking of Stonington now, particularly where you were a happier bunny. Were you excused the routine of the base? Or
oh,
you?
No.
So you got stuck in with the rest?
Oh, no, this detestable gash job. And you see, base, well, I'll come back, that's the thing about the dish, and cooking, you know, baking. So you try and let the dough rise as little as possible and make bricks for bread. So it lasted a bit longer and so on. No, those jobs were not welcomed. But just about Stonington, I was reading because of this meeting about Stonington. You remember, you've heard from the others that it was an ice tank. And I see that in thaw, water would flow in over the windowsills. And even when we were doing well, you'd lift a floorboard and it would be 1 inch below the floorboard. Just clean it, then water straight through. So, yeah, there was a lot of... but, yes, no, you took part in all the activities. Not that you enjoyed them, but it was only fair to share. Mm. You know? A doctor in that situation is kind of redundant in many ways. It's there for emergency. It's so famous when someone actually has to do something. Malcolm Evans, did you ever come across? Anyway, I think he did an appendix once, and of course it was a world-shattering affair. But no, you're one of the guys, and I mean, it's a fair deal if you can go on the journeys, you can do the work. That's all right. Yeah.
Is there something that I haven't asked you about which you wanted to talk about?
Oh, I don't know. I was curious about whether the serious episodes had been recorded by others. There must be a myriad things that are not in the record, and if we went through, we'd find them. But no, not really.
Well, perhaps I could just quiz you a bit more about the trip with Peter Gibbs to try and find the three men, or the part of the trip you made. What's your memory of that? Because were you in a tearing hurry? Was there a panic on? Was it a desperation?
Oh, no. It was carefully done. Camp on shore. Pass a bay and unload the sledge and run right round the bay as quickly as you could to survey the shores and so on. No, it was very carefully done. But of course it was midwinter, not a pleasant time at all. For example, while Peter and John were on the way to the Faroe Islands, I remember walking, I don't know who was with me, with a camera slung round my neck in this cold temperature, and walking into a slush patch immersed up to my neck.
No?
Well, he pulled me out with the ice axe and I ran back to the refuge hut. But the reason the story's interesting is that the camera was so cold that there'd been instant freezing, and not one drop of water had got into the camera, and it worked for the rest of the time there. But no, it was a well-executed, careful search. In, as you know, my feeling in a hopeless situation. Not a good time. Not a good time. But the others were lost to north of us, weren't they?
Yes.
In these accidents.
That was a bad year.
Was it a bad year all round? Yeah. Well, as you can see, it could have happened to anybody, and even worse things could have happened. We were always entertained by the Argentines to the north of us, Argentinians to the north of us, because they apparently they chose their heaviest, smallest, roundest person and tied him on a rope. And he was the crevasse tester. You know. Oh, okay, move on. Now, it... well, you've simulated a lot of thoughts. But anyway, that's that journey was well done, safely done, except that the bit we've already discussed. Yeah.
Did you ever join the Antarctic Swimming Club?
Well, often. Yes, I used to... as you remember, I said earlier on, I don't know which island it was, but I went for a swim on my own, and there was Peter swimming too. So, yes, and I remember swimming at Stonington, jumping off the ice edge and not being able to climb up out, and the other guys had to come and rescue me. Yes, I don't know why one found any pleasure in this, but we continued that tradition in Canada, where Christmas parties, there was always a snow plunge, you know. I got the job in Canada largely because of my time in the South and with the MRC, because when Canada changed to Medicare, the hospitals, instead of having a large group of indigent patients who had nowhere else to go, were all now private patients for everybody. But the Indian hospital, the Kamsel Hospital, built for the care of native peoples in the north, in Edmonton, wasn't like that. It had the clientele of native peoples. And the university wanted to put a clinic in there, and I had this sort of cold background, so that's how I got the job. Yeah, I guess my career has always been a chance event here and there, you know.
Yeah. It sounds to me that you are lucky to be alive.
I think so.
I think there were a number of incidents in your Antarctic experience those couple of years where it could easily have been another outcome.
Oh, very much so. To tell the truth, the most vivid in my head is at a drunken party being locked back in the surgery. I mean, nobody knows about this. Locked back in the surgery to shut me up. And I climbed out of the porthole, not exactly in control of my motion, and up back over the railing to join the party. And that would have been a real ender, because nobody would have known. I'd have just disappeared, and that would have been that.
This is on the Biscoe?
Yeah.
On which part of the journey?
I don't know. Well, early on, before I settled down.
On the way south the first time?
I think so, yes. But there have been many such occasions since, do you know? As you know, I got very interested in flying, and there have been flying episodes, and the whole of life is a risky business, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, if you don't view it as a risky business and wrap everybody in cotton wool, I don't think they ever grow.
So how did the Antarctic change you? Did you come back a different man?
I don't think so. I don't know what you think, but by your early 20s, you're pretty set, aren't you? No, I don't think it did. There are some people who see a goal and can see nothing else and go for it and accomplish and become distinguished and so on. And there are others, and if you'll forgive me for saying so, I suspect your life is a little bit that way, where you follow your nose, where it takes you, and if you're lucky, it becomes a good life. And I think mine has been a follow-the-nose kind of life. Where opportunity came, you took it, or didn't take it and then regretted, whatever. But yes, it's been all right.
Thank you for sharing it with me.
Oh, thank you for asking about it. I didn't really think there'd ever be opportunity to talk about it to a third party.